So we might as well get started. Hello, I'm Michael Filippo. I'm a partner here in the New York real estate practice. This is another installment of our Law and Education Forum, a continuing theme on the skills and services we offer in the law and education world and some of the popular themes that our clients are interested in. I'm joined by my colleagues Brian O'Connor, who's a partner and co-chair of the Tax and Wealth Planning Practice, and Michael Bloom, a counsel here in the New York office and the tax group as well. I'm just pretending to be a tax lawyer today, so they'll catch me if I run afoul. So thank you everyone for braving the weather. CLE is being offered, so if you haven't had a chance to sign in yet, please make sure you get your credit. There's a sign-in sheet right outside. So today's panel is going to be discussing federal income tax and New York real property tax exemption aspects of real estate transactions that a lot of our not-for-profit, university, cultural institution, et cetera, clients find themselves facing as part of planning and structuring a potential real estate transaction. So we're going to do a brief overview of what these exemptions are and what the rules are, and then dive into some do's and don'ts, things that might that are permissible and things that might run you afoul of the rules a bit. Then we have a few case studies that we're going to go through, kind of applying the rules to a couple of hypothetical situations, and then we'll open it up to questions. And at the end, there are some more detailed materials that get into the wall of text and case sites that I'm sure you don't want us reciting to you, so we'll be able to take those with you and have them as a reference. So we'll start with... Sorry, I forgot I had a clicker. All right, we're going to start with discussion of the real property tax exemption. So real property tax exemption is a two-part test. It has to be owned by a qualifying entity, and the mandatory class is charitable, educational, hospital, moral, or mental improvement of men, women, or children, religious, benevolent, Bible, enforcement of law relating to children and animals, historical, infirmary, library, literary, missionary, patriotic, public playground, scientific, and supervised youth sportsmanship or tract, educational, which would be the category most germane to our current audience. So it's a two-part test. Not only do you have to be one of these qualifying entities, and being a 501c3 is helpful, but not determinative of the finding that's required in order to get the exemption. So they ask you right on the first page of the application if you are federally tax exempt. But if you don't actually fit into one of these categories that I've just mentioned, you do not qualify for the exemption. So that's the first part of the test, is that the entity has to qualify. The second part of the test is that the use of the property has to be consistent with that purpose. So even if you are a federally tax-exempt entity that would otherwise qualify for a real property tax exemption, if you decide to open and operate a Starbucks, you're not going to be tax-exempt from real property tax for that parcel, unless you have a statutory exemption, which actually some of our clients are fortunate enough to have. I don't think they've done one of those in probably a century, but dare to dream. Interesting notes about it. So it has to be renewed every year. The renewal applications actually just went out recently, so it's probably in your inbox if not already filed and returned for many of you. And another interesting thing people don't often realize, it goes away automatically every time you convey. So even if you created a not-for-profit affiliate and you're simply dropping the property into that for insulation for liability purposes, you would have to reapply in the name of that entity, and it doesn't stick around until they catch it. Upon recording of a deed, even to another not-for-profit, it's going to go away. It doesn't also automatically exempt you from other charges or taxes from the city, for example, water, electric, mortgage recording tax, transfer taxes. There are exemptions that apply, and oftentimes profits fit into certain of these categories. Houses of worship are exempt from water. transfer tax. There's an exemption from the city portion, not the state portion. Mortgage recording tax is a far more narrow exemption, and generally most not-for-profits would not qualify. So just laying it out, there are other considerations. You don't automatically get carte blanche.
Michael, I've got a quick question. I'm
sure.
Curious the degree of enforcement on these types of provisions.
You know, we have seen an uptick. As you may know, the city is looking for revenue from many sources. So there has been a push in enforcement and a strict application of the rules. There's been some articles about religious institutions that were renting out their hall for functions, which can work under the federal tax exemption rules, as we'll see in a moment, but does not work under the real property tax exemption. So you'll see these enforcement actions. Another hot topic is any transfer tax that claims no change in beneficial ownership. The city's auditing almost all of those as a matter of course right now. So there really is a push to seek and enforce these various provisions.
I can just give a little anecdote where I was working with Suzanne on a project where my institution is planning to lease out some space on this campus for a non-exempt purpose, and you know, we had a signed term sheet, a non-binding term sheet, but we had a signing ceremony, and we invited some reporters, and there's a story in the New York Times, but we had not entered into any lease. There was no recording. There was nothing was happening, actually. We just had the ceremony and shook hands. And after the article was in the Times, we got a letter, from the taxing authority saying, okay, I guess your exemption no longer applies, or you know, show us that it does. We were filing a building permit or something, and it was rejected because we had some, multi-million dollar tax bill showing up. So
they're reading the newspaper.
They're reading the newspaper.
Wow.
Wow.
Yes.
Is there any de minimis exception for allowing others to use your space?
For real property tax purposes, and the rules are distinct, it's actually one of the themes that I think we want to highlight here, is what works under one paradigm does not necessarily work under the other. There are exemptions with respect to uses that are ancillary to the core function. For example, a university operating a concession stand for their students. Those types of uses are generally permitted. If it is, however, a real estate transaction with a non-affiliated entity, something that's not self-operated, even though it's revenue-generating, Starbucks example, even if it's a small portion of your overall real estate empire, and in the grand scheme of things, we're talking about 2,000 square foot, storefront out of a several hundred thousand square foot campus, there is no exemption in New York. One of the interesting notes also, just to flag here, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues, is if a not-for-profit leases a space from a for-profit entity, don't expect to get a real estate tax exemption that would be a benefit to the landlord that they could then pass on to you. It's not the way the rules work. There are ways to structure in terms of something that approximates ownership, if it's a true ground lease for a significant term. There's also a complex structure of a leasehold condominium, which can work in that area, but that's probably a little more too granular for our discussion today. So you actually have to own the thing in order to qualify for the exemption.
I'd also add to Denise's question that I think that a trigger for the EOF is the existence of a lease. So there are a lot of ways that a third party could use your space that doesn't involve you leasing it to them. So, for example, if there's a part of your facility that's managed by an outside party and might be used occasionally by outside parties, that might fly under the radar because there's no lease to report on the renewal form. Right.
So if they're reading the papers, you may want to interview everyone coming through your doors for Confederates. And with that, I'll pass over for a high-level discussion of the federal income tax exemption.
Well, there's two sets of issues. One is the tax issues related to maintaining your exemption. Michael, maybe say a word about that. And the second set of issues relate to unrelated business income tax, because If you're exempt, that's great. That generally means that you don't have to pay tax on your earnings, which is the whole point of being exempt from a federal income tax standpoint. But if you're entering into an unrelated business, then you could be subject to unrelated business income tax on that unrelated business income that you generate from that unrelated business. So the so-called UBTI and UBIT provisions, which are just these concepts, are what you need to worry about if you are not endangering your exemption. You still might be subject to tax, depending on what it is that you do. And we'll go through some of the details.
All right. So with that, we're going to get into some high-level do's and don'ts, also continuing on the federal income tax side.
Sure. Mike, you want to start?
Yeah. So we're talking generally about the two exemptions. You have your federal exemption for federal income tax and then the real property. And as Michael talked about, just being tax exempt at the federal level is not going to be good enough at the state level for real property. So at the federal level, as a general matter, schools and universities are exempt from federal income tax under 501c3. If they are organized and operated exclusively for their educational purpose. And the statute uses the term exclusively, but as courts have interpreted over the years, it means there is some leeway there, not much, and for that purpose, the boundary between at what point are you tipping the scales and now substantially doing something outside your mission is not clear. It's facts and circumstances, and for that reason, the general rule of thumb in our world is don't even go down that path. Whether it's a private equity investment set up a UBIT blocker, or whether it's one of these real property transactions, structure it in such a way to avoid UBIT, an unrelated business activity altogether. And that's what we're going to talk about with our examples. And so there are a few things that are generally considered okay under the code and the regulations. If you're just renting the property, it's a fixed lease arrangement, pretty standard. That will not generate UBIT. That's not going to potentially jeopardize your tax-exempt status. There are certain lease arrangements that might, and we'll get into that, but your typical kind of fixed rent payment is going to be okay.
And Mike, one thing to point out is if you look at the handout, we have an example of renting out space for a function without providing an ancillary service. And that last phrase is what is particularly important from a UBIT point of view and potentially an exemption point of view, but really we're talking more about UBIT at this point in time.
Yes.
So if you're providing some type of a service and really some portion of what you're being paid for is the service, well, that's likely to lead to taxation.
The services that are customarily considered related to renting real property, trash collection, providing like heat, water, cleaning the common areas, that is all generally fine. But if you're going above and beyond that, that'll like offering dry cleaning services or something like that.
Maid services.
Yeah, that's going to be more. Yeah,
sure. Right. That's right.
Running a speakeasy, that could be a problem. There are other things on this list that are generally considered de minimis, a bingo game, dances that are staffed by volunteers, selling property that has been donated to the organization, that's the thrift shop exception. You see a lot of schools kind of at all levels running these sales and charities. Insubstantial lobbying, one of the things we'll also kind of touch on is you can do an insubstantial amount of lobbying for a cause, but you cannot back a particular candidate or a party, and so there's a distinction there. But again, the line between insubstantial and substantial is not clear, so the generally safe to avoid those types of activities altogether.
Mike, I want to take them back to bingo games for just a moment, because we've had clients who were fire departments got into a lot of tax trouble over bingo, because there's a general sense that bingo is often okay. We typically don't think of bingo as this terribly abusive thing that people.
It's a gateway drug.
That's right.
Right.
But if you're providing bingo in a jurisdiction that permits for-profit organizations to provide bingo. Now that changes everything, and then it will become subject to tax, whereas if you're providing bingo someplace where there are not for-profits providing bingo, well, then that may not be subject to tax. So as we see a little bit of spread in gaming taking place throughout the country, a lot of the things that exempts were able to do without tax concerns might be subject to change. And bingo is one of these things, and we've actually had some clients who are struggling with that. Yes?
Ryan, a question on the ancillary services. Let's say you're renting out space. What about something such as providing audiovisual support, food?
That can be an issue because it's customary services that are okay. And Michael talked about the first ones that come to mind, and you know, lighting, trash removal, those types of things could in some cases be security. But if you're talking about something like providing equipment, and maybe if you're providing an equipment expert, those types of things can change the dynamic. It could lead to taxation.
The other thing is, what is customary will also depend on what is the real property that you're renting. If the stuff is built, if it's an auditorium and there's kind of built-in AV equipment, that will just be part of the what's customary for that piece of property. The other thing is you can also rent the personal property that is associated with the real estate. So if you're not operating it, you're just saying, take it all. There's some other stuff here you can use in connection with, you know, you're running the business. That's okay. But if you're the one that's providing the service, then you get into some issues.
So that's an excellent point. It's really probably the line that you would want to be most concerned about is providing the personnel. If you had a theater or a room that had all that equipment already in there, there's likely to be a way to make it work. It's the personnel that would be the problem.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
All right. So that was the do's list. Let's go to the don'ts list.
Yeah. The don't list is basically the flip side of the do's list. So it's insubstantial lobbying versus substantial lobbying. Related business activity, like running a cafeteria in the university for the convenience of the faculty and student body, that's going to be okay. But going above and beyond and operating a hotel or restaurant, that would be unrelated to an educational mission. Again, political campaigning, if you're not lobbying for an issue that is of importance to your educational mission, but you're favoring a candidate, you're holding a Trump rally, that is not allowed. And then again, providing either the ancillary services or the there's a debt finance exception. If you are renting property that you acquired with indebtedness, that will generate a UBIT. And you have to prorate the amount of rent that you get between what was acquired using debt and what was acquired using equity.
Let me jump in and kind of take a step back. There's really two categories of unrelated business income, taxable income that can apply to university. You're looking at the unrelated business income. Let's say you have any side business that's unrelated to your function. That's one category. The second is debt-financed income, because generally passive income, things like interest and dividends and royalties, those amounts are not subject to taxation. But if you encumber the property that is going to generate those types of income, then it can be subject to taxation. The idea was Congress wanted exempt organizations to enjoy an exemption, but they didn't want those organizations to kind of lever up that exemption to effectively multiply it through encumbering the property that produces the income. So if you're going to debt finance the property, you've got to take into account the prospect of UBIT because it's debt financed income. Now, universities have an exception that applies to pretty much just universities and pension plans when it comes to real estate if they meet certain requirements. So there's a kind of a beneficial status within the world of exempts that universities and pension plans have as to real estate. So here, if you're talking about renting out property that's encumbered by debt, that ought to give rise to an alarm that we've got a debt finance issue to worry about. There's an exception that we might be able to fit within, but we've got to think about that and make sure that we do fit within that exception. So something to be very, very concerned about.
All right. And now we can talk about do's and don'ts from the real property side of the house. So as we were just discussing, income-generating uses that are ancillary or related to the main purpose of the organization are generally allowable and won't jeopardize the real property tax exemption, such as a concession, as we were just discussing, or operating a summer camp with educational curriculum. Even if it generates revenue, it's generally going to be permitted. Renting out a portion of the organization's property to another recognized nonprofit organization for use in accordance with that organization's charitable purpose. Now, oftentimes people ask, does it have to be the same purpose? Does it have to be educational? No. As long as they would independently qualify for the real property tax exemption, it's okay. So you can have a school renting to a church. Please.
Can you charge a market rent on that?
We are getting to that, exactly. To jump ahead a bit, essentially the rent is capped at the local carry cost of that portion of the exempt's real property. So there's a lot that goes into that, and it's definitely something you want to sit down with your accountants about, because a lot of things can go into what's carry. A portion time of executives, the actual cost of operating the real property. So that gets a bit into the weeds and the accounting purposes, and you certainly want to talk to your professionals about that.
Michael, that's another clear difference, of course, between the real property exemption and the income tax exemption, because there, of course, market rent is perfectly permissible.
Right. And renting to for-profits is perfectly permissible. So we're going to – it's one of those warning signs, again, that, every square is a rectangle, but every rectangle is not a square. The rules don't always align exactly. Renting a portion of the parking area for use to further the organization's charitable purpose. You can charge rent for coming to events at the university. And this is where we get to the end. Renting out at a rental rate which exceeds the carrying, maintenance, and depreciation cost of the portion of the property so rented. And the preferably not category. Use of the property that is motivated to generate commercial profits. I mean, that's kind of the bright line statement of the test. So Starbucks out. Don't mean to harp on them. Enjoy their products. Renting out property to for-profit companies or individuals. Again, that's a distinction. Renting out parking areas for private use. So we've had clients say, well, this lot sits fallow on the weekends. Can I, and there's a stadium down the road, can I make money renting those spots? And that would jeopardize the real property tax exemption for that lot. And use of the property in violation of city and state zoning laws. That will also cause loss of exemption. So here's the caution sign that we're saying. The rules are not always the same. So take one of the examples we discussed. Renting out the basement auditorium function hall for a wedding, whether or not you're providing the bartenders that are a big no-no. That would be fine under federal income tax exemption purposes. That is not fine under real property tax exemption purposes. Renting out to a for-profit at a rate below the UBIT threshold. You wouldn't be paying UBIT tax on the federal side, but you would be jeopardizing your real property tax exemption because it's to a for-profit entity. So kind of have to think of it holistically when you're trying to structure your transactions. So with that, we're going to jump into a few hypothetical case studies to kind of apply what we've been discussing. So case study number one, a university located in Queens, New York, which is organized as a New York not-for-profit organization and is a tax-exempt entity, owns a theater. The real estate on which the theater is located is exempt from New York real property tax. The university's covering charges for the theater are about $5,000 per month. The university is approached by Alvin Ailey, a nonprofit dance company, to use the theater to hold rehearsals and put on a public performance. Alvin Ailey agrees to rent the theater from the university for a three-month period for a total of $15,000 in rent. You didn't think there would be math, did you? But, all right. So now we can discuss a bit. Why don't you guys lead it off?
Sure. So on the federal income tax side, is this okay? And the short answer is yes. As Brian talked about, from a federal income tax standpoint, it really doesn't matter who you're renting to. Is it a for-profit entity? Is it a not-for-profit entity? It also generally doesn't matter if you're charging only your costs or a market rent. That either way, it's not going to be UBIT. It's one of those exceptions to UBIT, which is passive income, rents, dividends, interest, royalties, etc. So that is not going to be a problem either for your tax-exempt status generally or whether or not you're going to be generating UBIT.
Subject to just the caveat that if you acquire the space through debt financing, you'd want to make sure that you fit within the exception to debt-financed UBIT that universities can enjoy.
So does this lease jeopardize the university's New York real property tax exemption for the real property on which the theater is located? And the answer is no. This is an entity that would otherwise independently qualify for a real property tax exemption. However, the rent that can be charged must be limited to the allocated carrying maintenance and depreciation costs for the theater itself.
So, Michael, if we receive $30,000 in your example, and
right,
$15,000, we have a problem.
We got a problem. We either need to sharpen our pencils on what the carrying maintenance and depreciation costs are. And an interesting distinction between the UBIT discussion and the real property tax discussion is it's a zero-sum game on the real property side of the house. So if you're exceeding the permissible thresholds, the result is that portion of the real property becomes fully taxable. Whereas on an income issue, while that income is no longer sheltered within that safe harbor, you pay income tax and you don't otherwise jeopardize the overall tax exemption of your enterprise. So it's an important distinction.
Yes, so in addition to potentially jeopardizing your real property tax exemption, do you also potentially lose your transfer tax exemptions when you sell the property?
It's a different determination on the transfer tax side of the house. So you would lose your real property transfer tax, but the test that's applied when you're applying, I'm sorry, you would lose your real property tax exemption, but the test that's applied when you're transferring real property under the transfer tax forms in New York is whether you fit in the certain categories that are permitted, which align very closely. So it's not that you would no longer be a charitable organization that's entitled to the exemption from transfer tax. It's simply that you carried on this purpose and you lost your real property tax exemption. So again, the two are not necessarily connected. You still qualify. All right.
Okay, so now that's kind of the basic answers with the hypo given, but what if we change the scenario a little bit? Again, charging a market rate of rent, that's okay from the federal side, but that's a problem from the state side. All right, so what if we charge market rent and wanted a piece of the upside? In this case, let's say the university wants 10% of the box office gross, which is, you know, something that you kind of commonly see in other, like Broadway shows, where the theater gets a piece of the upside. Can the university do that here? From the federal tax side, they can. You can get a piece of the gross, but you can't get a piece of the net. That's the distinction. If you're participating in the profits, kind of below the line, you're considered to be a partner with the dance company, and then being a partner means that you're considered to be doing what your partners are doing, which is outside your mission. So that's why if you want a piece of the upside, it's got to be on a gross basis. It can't be on a net basis.
A couple of comments here. Mm-hmm. One is that you might think if you had a $30,000 plus 10% of the net, that maybe the only piece that's subject to a special tax is the net piece, that the $30,000 would be okay, and any net participation that you had above the $30,000 would be problematic. Unfortunately, it becomes a zero-sum rule at this point, and if you had a structure like that, the entire rent would become subject to UBIT, which, of course, is a very draconian result. So it's something to be very, very mindful of, is if you do want that participation, and, of course, that's a valuable thing to have, be certain that it's specifically on a gross basis and that it couldn't be interpreted based on your particular facts to be some type of a net arrangement, because you would put the entire rental amount at risk for taxation. And something, a good guide here is not only what other universities might be doing, but real estate investment trusts have a similar rule. So finding out what REITs are doing is also a good guideline when it comes to this type of issue, because you obviously don't want to subject the entire rental stream to potential taxation.
REITs also have similar rules about customary versus non-customary services, so there's also a lot of guidance to be had on that issue in the REIT context. Okay, then now getting down to this other issue we alluded to a bit before, ancillary services, providing a sound technician to assist with the performance. Again, that's not going to be permissible because that is an ancillary service and you're providing the personnel to assist with that feature. Now, if there was equipment there in the theater and you also rented them that equipment as part of the overall lease, that would be okay from a federal tax standpoint. Concessions are a little more interesting. If the performance that is going on is an exempt performance, then concessions are okay because it's basically the activity itself that's providing a nonprofit dance show is generally considered to be consistent with a educational or charitable mission. And there's an example in the regulations about this. But as we'll talk about in a different example, what if it's not a educational or cultural show? What if it's a rock concert or something like that? Well, then that also taints your concessions. So concessions generally piggyback off of the nature of the show, the nice nature of the activity. So like a football game, you go to like a college football game, well, that's okay because that's part of the sports and educational function of the university. Concessions are a little different. That can change.
What about the political rally? I think we don't probably have to spend a lot of time on that.
Yeah.
That's not going to work, so not much to say there.
It's actually, it leads to an interesting point, though. Just recently, I was doing a license agreement, and space is at such a premium here in the city, especially in the educational world, that oftentimes, in that collaborative spirit that educational institutions enjoy, if there is an unused portion of space, so look to collaborate with some of your educational colleagues. So we had two schools who were in close proximity to one another, and one of them wanted to have sports practices during times that the gym in the other school wasn't necessarily going to be used. So one of the things that we drafted here was essentially they would have unfettered use of the space during period where their uses wouldn't be monitored. So it was important to craft prohibitions on activities that could otherwise jeopardize the federal income tax or real property tax exemption of the institution, and also to craft an indemnity. If these items were triggered, the defense obligation would be on the party that was using the space, and any liability that stemmed from it, which could be astronomical, would be covered by the other entity. So something to consider when drafting in these types of transactions.
One question.
Sure.
What if, let's say in this example, Alvin Ailey wanted to hold a fundraiser? Would that be permissible to rent in that circumstance to a nonprofit that is raising funds?
Wouldn't
or
be
charging
subject.
Would be subject.
It would not be.
Because you wouldn't be sharing in the profits of the fundraising. And from the real estate tax perspective, you're still leasing to a charitable organization. That is, as long as you're not participating in the upside of that fundraising effort in a manner that would exceed your carrying maintenance and depreciation costs, you're good from that perspective as well.
Okay. Thanks.
Unless the fundraiser is a political rally.
Right.
All right. Case study number two, variation on a theme. So same example as before, but now the university is approached by the Upright Citizens Brigade, a for-profit comedy troupe and the feeder to many of the current actors on Saturday Night Live.
Okay.
To our examples.
Yeah. So this example basically gets at what if it's a for-profit entity, not a nonprofit entity that you're leasing to. From a federal tax standpoint, again, we don't care, but it doesn't change the nature of the rental income that's received. So again, like if it's if they're holding a fundraiser or if they're trying to make money or it's a clear for-profit enterprise, that doesn't change the nature of the income that's received. That's not UBIT. It's not going to jeopardize tax-exempt status.
does this lease jeopardize the university's New York real property tax exemption for the real property on which the theater is located? And the answer is yes, because this is a for-profit entity that will be coming in to use the space, regardless of the rent that's charged. Now, an interesting thing to flag here, and we will discuss it in the next example, is this doesn't mean that the use is prohibited or illegal. It essentially becomes a determination of, is the juice worth the squeeze? Is the revenue stream that is likely to be generated from this use worth the real estate property tax that's going to be now assessed on that portion of the real property? And that leads to interesting questions of how that's calculated, how you insulate the balance of the university's facilities from that taxation, all of which we will get into a little more detail about in just a moment.
So, Michael, maybe you're going to get to this in your next example, but this is a situation where the university is actually leasing the whole theater for a set period of time. So it's truly a real property transaction.
Right.
As opposed to a university that is operating the theater and booking for-profit acts, you know, where their students can come and see a rock concert or a comedy troupe or something else that happens to be for-profit, but it's not giving over the space to that entity for more than, you know, the one show.
Right.
Or some rehearsals. Is that...
I mean, generally, that wouldn't be a revenue-generating exercise. Usually, you have to pay to get the acts to come in. But that's right. That's not within what the pursuit here, because it's no longer the use of a space by a different party. It's still being used by the university, but you're hosting an outside entity.
Yeah.
Even if it's open to the public, the use? I mean, your students as well as the public.
The test is key to who is using the space. And if it's an event that the university is putting on, essentially, and welcoming the public and their students, et cetera, the use is still by the university. And generally, if it's a pay transaction, it's not being done to generate a profit.
Yeah. These examples are basically full-fledged leases. But it is slightly different analysis. What if you're not leasing the space to this comedy troupe, this organization, but you're actually hiring them to come in and do a show for the student body, and maybe there are people outside the student body that want to buy tickets too, the people in the general public. You have the symphony orchestra coming, and this is a great opportunity, and a lot of people want to see it. Is that okay? This is a little different than a rental arrangement. You're kind of doing an activity. You're putting on the show. You're charging tickets. You get the income from those tickets. And the regulations actually speak to an example like this and say that depends on the nature of the show. If it's your Alvin Ailey type of organization, it's something cultural, it's a symphony, then that is going to be okay. That's not going to generate UBIT. And then again, if you sell concessions related to that show, that's all tied up with the nature of the show itself, so that's also going to be okay. But what if it's something like a UCB or a rock concert? That is not going to fall within the scope of the educational mission of the university. So if they were to go ahead and book that and run that, that would generate UBIT. Their concessions would be tainted, and that's kind of the bifurcation of the analysis. It doesn't depend on whether or not they're outside folks. You can sell tickets in addition to the students to other people. It's really going to turn on the nature of the performance itself.
And you can see how this could get gray
yeah.
in a lot of places, because there's, I could probably make an argument that UCB has an education
right.
element to it. So there are going to be gray cases.
Right. It's kind of a fact-sensitive case. If it becomes, you know, the premier rock venue in Queens, that's probably a bad fact. But if it's kind of in furtherance of exposing, if you tie it back to the mission, then it's likely to be within the safe harbor.
And from the tax policy standpoint, and I think unfortunately we're pretty far away from your tax policy in general, it tends to be more about revenue these days, but the idea, the whole basis for these rules are that it's not fair for those for-profit companies who are putting on rock concerts to have to compete with organizations that are doing the same thing and not having to pay tax That's the underlying policy for this rule. Whereas if it's cultural, that's different. That's less likely to be something that a for-profit organization would be seeking to compete with a not-for-profit.
That's an interesting point, because at first I always thought you're not-for-profit, the rationale is you shouldn't be allowed to engage in for-profit activity. That's inconsistent with being a not-for-profit. But really, it's a competition analysis. So you shouldn't be allowed, just because you're tax exempt, to undertake an unrelated business and try and make money and then not have to pay tax on your income, when someone else out there next door doing the exact same thing is now at a competitive disadvantage. And because that's the rationale, the standard for UBIT does slightly change depending on the facts and circumstances, where you are located, what's like the relative a competition for that service in your industry. So,
bingo, for example.
Yeah,
bingo.
So, like, if you're a rural school and you want to provide, sell toiletries and stuff like that to your student body who doesn't really have access to that stuff or easy access, that would be okay. But if you're located in New York and you want to do the exact same thing, that would be UBIT. Again, the exact same activity, but it's going to depend on that competitive advantage that you might have for that particular service. So it's a little interesting.
Interesting history is that these provisions came into the Internal Revenue Code not primarily as revenue generators, not primarily to kind of take a stick to exempt organizations. They came as a result of the efforts of for-profit businesses looking to level the playing field. That's how
spaghetti
they
case. So this leads us to our third case study. We're stepping outside of the concert venues and talking about a valuable and developable piece of property. The university owns an undeveloped parcel of land in Queens that, because of rising real estate prices, has become highly valuable. Many developers want to buy this parcel from the university to build residential apartments. How can university monetize this undeveloped real property and put such money to use at the university without jeopardizing its federal tax exempt status and or its New York real property tax exemption?
And I'll start by talking about the issues that arise here. They tend not to be exemption qualification issues as much as they're UBIT issues. A big thing that an exempt can't do without UBIT is sell inventory. And there's a tax distinction between something that's inventory and something that is a capital asset. So if you've got in this case, I guess we're talking about a parcel of land, I'm assuming it's undeveloped. If you sell that in total to a buyer, whether it be a developer or whoever, it's likely to generate a capital gain that would not be subject to UBIT. That's good news. Before you sell it, you subdivide it and you start to finish off lots, now you've created inventory. And the inventory, if sold, would be subject to UBIT. So classic case, and Michael and I will run into this from time to time, you've got an exempt organization where you have a farmer who has a nice piece of land, somebody wants to develop that land to create homes or what have you, and they want the seller to do a number of things before the sale will take place. Well, that should be an alarm bell that goes off, is you want to do as little as possible before you sell that land, because in the process of doing what the buyer might want you to do, you could convert the land from something that wouldn't be subject to tax to something that would be subject to tax. And it's a facts and circumstances, but the way that we often talk about it is, has there been a shovel in the ground? If you do something tangible to the property, that's likely to change its character from a tax point of view. So if you got that parking lot that Michael was talking about that you were thinking about having people park their cars at the football game, and you maybe didn't think you wanted to do that because of the real property exemption issue, if you sold that without doing anything to the property, chances are that's not going to be subject to UBIT, and that's good news. But if the developer says, hey, can you subdivide it? Can you do a few things to the kind of tailor the lots for us a bit, then you're going to end up in a much different position.
What do you mean by subdivided?
It's if you've got one parcel of land, if you go ahead and you turn that into 20 different little parcels.
Just as a legal matter.
Exactly.
But if you were to create a separate, if you were to subdivide the lot, just to subdivide the portion that you're planning to transfer.
Oh, that's, well, key thing there, you could probably do that as long as you didn't do more tangibly to the property that you were going to transfer. That's usually the big crossing the line point. You start to physically alter the condition of the property, you've got a real problem at that point. And the second issue that comes up, putting aside the inventory issue, is like the so many things that we've been talking about, debt financing, because real estate is unique in that it tends to be more encumbered than other types of assets. So if you were going to have a joint venture with a developer, which of course is extraordinarily common for exempt organizations to do with real estate, it's likely that there's going to be some debt involved in that transaction. And you could, for example, develop the property, build an office building, and then lease the property to a tenant, not provide non-customary services, only provide customary services, and that rent would generally qualify as not subject to UBIT. But if the property's encumbered, there's additional exceptions to meet. And as I mentioned before, universities have somewhat of a favored treatment when it comes to this issue. But you want to make sure that you cross the T's and dot the I's to make sure you're not subject to UBIT on that rental income, which is, as a general rule, exempt.
So, Brian, to just try to explore where this line is a little
sure.
bit more, let's say a university has a parcel like a parking lot and they want to sell it. And in addition to creating a separate tax lot so they can sell it, which is fine, they decide they're going to go through the necessary, again, get the necessary approval to change the zoning of the property to build, so someone can come along and build condos or an office building on the site. Is that's not a physical change to the property in preparation for the sale, but are those activities that would tend to lead to a conclusion that the university is selling inventory?
The kind of the general rule is the less you can do, the better. A clear delineation, if you're looking for that, is going to be the physical changes to the property. So I would contend that you probably could do things with the zoning, but the best practice would be to push as much as you could to the buyer so that you had as little on your list to do as possible. But the bright line is the physical change. Now, that it's a facts and circumstances test, so could there be a set of circumstances without a physical change to the property that could lead to an inventory result? That certainly is possible, which is why better to do as little as possible. Sometimes you don't have a choice, but as you know, as long as anyone.
Right, well,
comes
the
valuation.
Rezoning could increase the value.
Exactly,
sure.
So it's probably,
that's right.
You know, it's worse, but you wouldn't want to do it, obviously, because you're going to have to pay tax. What about something like demolishing the improvements? You know, you have a lot that's got a building on it that the university is no longer using, and they want to demolish the improvements and then sell it as vacant land for whatever reason. That
would concern me, because now you're altering the property in a physical way. So
okay.
I would think that that would take you over the line. Let the buyer go ahead and do that. Now, if you could somehow separate the demolition from the subsequent sale,
yeah.
That would be the other approach that you'd want to take. But if it was clear in the facts that the buyer said, demolish the property so I can buy it, mm-hmm. and did that, then I'd be worried about it.
So the next bullet circles back to the is the juice worth the squeeze example. So if you've made the determination that based on the value of this parcel, it will be worthwhile to permit this is more germane to a lease transaction than really a sale transaction, but to permit this non-exempt use to occur in this parcel. The question is, how do you then structure that so it's most advantageous to the university? The fear being, one, what is the tax that's going to be charged with respect to this use, and how do I box it in to make sure it doesn't taint the balance of my campus? So you can actually have it either way. It is possible to apply for a partial tax exemption, when you're doing your annual real property tax exemption application and not actually create separately bounded tax lots and simply make your rationale for the portion of the space based on the current assessment that should become taxable. So it doesn't necessarily require a tax lot subdivision, but a tax lot subdivision is also a viable alternative, the benefit to that being you have more assurance of what the boundaries are, and if that ticks and ties to the description of the leasehold premises, then you've pretty much insulated whatever your potential tax liability is going to be to that parcel, barring allowing access beyond the bounds of the lease into the balance of the campus. One of the interesting things that comes up here is thinking about what the assessed value of your real estate is. It's something a lot of not-for-profits don't have to think about a whole lot because you get your statement of account and you've got a nice little offset for the entire amount. So if it's gone unchallenged for decades, you could have an inflated assessment, and it may make sense as part of this exercise to go through a certiorari exercise to try and reduce that assessed value prior to the portion of the real property becoming taxable. Another thing to consider is what makes more sense, a ground lease or an outright sale of the parcel. One of the non-tax considerations here is control. Universities and educational institutions usually have a long history and anticipate an even longer future in their current locations, and ceding control of that parcel to become New York's next hottest nightclub or bingo den, even worse,
bingo den.
Could be a real concern. So retaining controls over what improvements can be built, what types of uses are permitted, what types of uses are prohibited, who is allowed to be an assignee, what qualifications do they have to meet? Those are considerations that admittedly are beyond the bounds of the real estate tax discussion we're having. But it, as part of making that real estate and income tax determination of how to structure the transaction, it's worthwhile to consider those.
Right. Just in terms of the co-development of a parcel that might have mixed educational space and non-educational space, residential portion or commercial portion of that such a mixed-use property probably will seek its own property tax exemption or abatement that might require that it be on a separate tax lot, so that might drive it
Right. And we've actually structured, jumping ahead a bit, as to whether or not to kind of separate out the uses and do a co-development, which is a transaction we in the real estate group have been very familiar with. We've structured condominiums in order to affect that aim. We've also done vertical subdivisions, which are a little known transaction where you avoid the need to actually enter into a condominium regime and form a board and do all the administration that goes along with that, and with certain reciprocal rights and obligations that can be captured in a reciprocal easement and covenant agreement. You could have separate fee ownership without a condominium regime of a box of air in the sky, as long as it has easements of support and a box below that. But that's one potential option that a lot of our clients have considered, especially developers are often touting their experience and in building and their ability to do so on a cost-efficient basis to carve out a base of the building for mission-driven purposes of the university or educational institution with residential above. So that's another viable option of pursuing this. I jumped ahead of it, though, so we can go back to profit participation as well, if you'd like to talk about
that. Oh, sure. One thing that I should say is, because this does come up often enough in our practices, is that if you did a joint venture with a developer, you have the land, the developer comes in, builds a building, and then you lease the property out in a way that would as a general, not generate UBTI, but you encumber the property. The tax rule that you need to meet in order to prevent the rental income from becoming subject to UBIT because it's debt financed is you have to, it's a rule called the fractions rule, and I won't bore the group with the deep details of the rule, but what it essentially does is it prevents you from pushing deductions that are otherwise available to the developer. So in an ideal world, what we would do is we would have a joint venture between an exempt and a taxable developer, and we would say, hey, let's send all the tax deductions to the developer. And that way the developer gets the benefit of those deductions. Exempt doesn't care because the exempt is exempt, doesn't need the deductions. But some of the rules that you would have to meet would prevent you from doing that. And in their effort to keep you from assigning too many deductions to the developer, they put a lot of other limitations on the deal that are unfortunate. It's a classic case of Congress seeing what they deem to be an abuse and overshooting the mark and having a much further reach than they really needed to have. So that's a complexity that comes into play with those types of transactions. But it can be worked through, and it tends to be something that you see with a lot of pension plans. But if a university wanted to do that, that there are structures that would permit them to do that. So you could have unlimited encumbrances on that building in your joint venture with a taxable person, and as a university, there's an approach that would allow you to escape tax.
One last point to hit as we squeeze into the last hour of our presentation. We do a lot of construction and development for not-for-profit entities here in the New York office, and one of the interesting aspects of it, which we haven't discussed so far, is New York sales and use tax. So if anyone, you and I in our personal capacities or a for-profit developer, builds a capital improvement, all of the bricks and mortar that go into that capital improvement are exempt from sales and use taxation, on the theory being that that gets capitalized into basis and ultimately the gain will be paid at the end of the day. However, anything that's not incorporated into the construction, think along the lines of tarps, drop cloths, paint brushes that are consumed in the process, equipment that's rented, scaffolding that's rented, which can add up to real dollars on a project. Now, if a sales tax exempt entity were to purchase that, just like running down to the store and buying a roll of paper towels, those purchases and rentals would be exempt from sales and use taxation. So there is a model here in doing a construction project for itself or as part of a ground lease. Oftentimes, the ground lessor is entitled to ownership of the real property, either at the conclusion of the term or as built. There is a structure, and it is complicated, so you want to do the math and make sure that it's worthwhile, whereby you appoint the contractor as your agent. And the contractor needs to have the ability to commit the credit of the organization. So again, you want to tailor this very carefully. But if it is done appropriately, the contractor can enjoy the benefit as the agent of the sales tax exempt ultimate owner of the property to make these types of consumable purchases or rentals on a sales tax exempt basis, which can add up to real dollars on your project. And we went a minute over. But if anyone has any questions, we're certainly happy to stick around and discuss. Pre-beard photo. Well, thank you, everybody, for taking time out of your morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.